Well, it being Wednesday and it being 21 and a half minutes past the hour, it being our time with Doug Greenwald this morning. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times, coming to us from Columbia, Maryland, where all that hot air rises over Washington and probably warms the climate around you, Doug, wouldn't you say? Or,
yeah. Well, I think there's a tendency for that, but I tell you, the last couple of days have been like not even getting to 50 degrees here and windy.
Oh.
And I keep asking myself, where is spring?
Well, June, July, somewhere along there, it's going to pop up. You've already had cherry blossoms, though. Maybe that was your spring, huh?
We have, and we've had two spurts of them, and then we've had cold spells, which actually has sort of drawn it out a little bit, which is good. And I think about 3 days ago, certain parts of the tidal basin were considered to be in peak display.
The tidal bay, Chesapeake Bay. You're so close to that. How does that change life for you?
You know, I'm not sure. I think on the eastern shore it does, because there's a lot of orchards over there, and that's often what you see. But I didn't appreciate it until we moved here in the 80s that the Chesapeake Bay is the greatest stretch of sailing water in the certainly the United States and maybe the world.
An amazing history to that. I remember reading James Michener's novel, Chesapeake, with avid interest because his history is so accurate and he weaves it throughout the story, even though it's a novel. It really gives you a feel for the place. And someday I'm going to get there and try a crab cake. I think that's the big deal, huh?
That is the big deal. Soft shell crabs being a particularly big deal. And a lot of crab aficionados here. Unfortunately, my wife is allergic to crab.
Oh,
so
no. Bummer.
We don't do any of that stuff here.
Okay. Well, you don't have to sneak out secretly, like late one evening?
I don't even have to sneak out secretly. She allows me to have crab cakes when we go out for a restaurant meal. And usually I jump on it wherever I see it. Mm. But one thing I don't do is go to Texas and order crab cakes.
Well, why not?
There's something about being indigenous.
Okay. Well, they probably come from Maryland here anyway.
Yeah, they probably do.
Yeah, I suspect so. Doug, we talk about biblical context, and that has to do with taking us back to Bible times, the first century in particular, the time when the Gospels were written and proliferated and began to teach and instruct. And back then, there were so many differences between that culture and ours today. And one of the points you make continuously is that we, with our Western eyes, our Western mindsets, often miss the original meaning. We have few clues as to what that language in the Bible might have meant to the original audience, how they would have received it and understood it and responded to it. One of the aspects that strikes me that's maybe a little more subtle than the geography and the political history and even linguistics, although this could be classified under linguistics, I guess, is allegories. Now, when we run across them in the Bible, we hear in the here and now today, the meaning zips right by us. There's a phrase that turns up in the Bible I'm kind of wondering about. It's called milk and honey. It's used to refer to the land of the Bible. Milk and honey, I'm not even sure what it means to us. What did it mean to them back then?
Well, let me, before I jump into that, and just respond to your use of the word allegory. When appropriate, allegorical appreciations of the text are fine. But there was a time in church history around the 300s to the 400s when allegory just got carried away and everything was interpreted allegorical in the Bible. And there were lots of abuses and lots of misunderstandings that came with that. So it's when you use the word allegory, it's everything in its right place. And I certainly think it's appropriate here. But just as a caution, you know, you can get too carried away with allegory, particularly, say, John 15, for example. You approach that whole thing allegorical. You can end up in a very, very different interpretive place. But
well, it's possible that when we read something and interpret it as an allegory, it's because of that history in the church of writing that way, when actually it was simply a literal statement and had no allegorical meaning. I guess that would be a pitfall.
Yeah, and in this particular case, I think if we went to people today in our world who had never been to Israel and who were not particularly familiar with the Bible, and we put in front of them land of milk and honey, what would that suggest in your mind? My guess is it would be a tropical resort, mm-hmm. or a vast oasis, or the next best thing to the Garden of Eden.
Something
perhaps.
Sweet and light and pleasant, in a very general sense.
Yeah, and that's anything but what this really means when appropriately understood. The phrase is flowing with milk and honey, and in the original Hebrew, the word flowing is probably best understood as an abundance of. So God says to his people in Egypt, I'm going to bring you to a land where there is an abundance of milk and honey. And to the Western mind, when it hears the word milk, being an old Midwesterner like you are, we think of Holstein cows.
As a matter of fact, yeah.
And dairy farms.
And Guernseys.
Exactly. And that's not what's being invoked here at all. From the point of view that a lot of the land is not flat for grazing in Israel, and probably three-quarters of the land doesn't get sufficient enough rain to grow consistent grasses and grains, which is requires a minimum of 16 inches a year. Down in the Negev, the northern Negev, where Beersheba is and where Abram first set up shop, you get about 10 inches of rainfall a year. So the notion of cows just doesn't cut it. And it turns out that the reference to milk is, and we still see it today if you drive through Amish country in Lancaster, or Lancaster, as they like to say it, Pennsylvania, the Amish still sell goat's fudge and goat cheese. And so the reference to milk really is one of goats. But I want to freeze that thought before coming back to honey, because we really have to tour this land to give ourselves a physical, geographical background or context into what some of this means. So when Abram came south from Haran and arrived at around Mount Hermon, Mount Hermon, and saw that 9,200-foot-high snow-capped mountain, and as he got into the foothills of Mount Hermon in the very northern part of the country, saw these raging artesian springs and this rushing water and all of this green land, green grass. And he didn't understand it at the time, but the soil up there is really rather productive, rather fertile. A lot of that soil is decomposed volcanic ash. The rock term is called basalt. Basalt has a very high metallic content, so when it disintegrates, the ground, the soil, has a very high metallic content, and it absorbs heat. And that really stimulates and prolongs the growing season in the north. Plus, if you throw into that mix, that equation, that they average at least 25 inches of rainfall a year, you have good soil, you have some reasonably flat land, the whole Hula Valley, the whole Jezreel Valley, you have abundant water, and everywhere you look, the predominant color is green. So, you know, when you think of the north in biblical times, you want to think green.
There were also forests there, weren't there, that disappeared during the Crusades, as I understand it. But there were many more trees in Bible times than since.
Absolutely. There were even cedars. Lots of oak, although it's a different kind of oak than the massive oaks that we're familiar here with in the West. But anyway, as Abram entered this land that God was going to give him, I'm sure he would have remembered the lushness, relatively speaking, of the north. Well, he continues on his journey south, and he goes 60 miles further south, and he gets to the hill country of Samaria, actually Shechem, where Jacob would have a well later on. And just in the space of 60 miles, we have a rapidly changing topography. It's much more rugged and hilly, 2,000, 3,000 feet ridges and deep, steep valleys. And it's much much more stony than the fertile land 60 miles to the north. And you can't do conventional agriculture here. At best, you're going to have to terrace the hillsides of these significant sloping ridges down to the valley, and maybe you'll grow olive trees and fig trees and grapes there. But if you look around, it tends to look a lot grayer, a whitish gray from all of the rock in the central part of the country. Then, if we go, say, another 70 miles south and get to Beersheba, probably 30 miles south of where Jerusalem is today, and where Abram is eventually going to set up shop, we see nothing but brown, tan, sand, because it gets 8 to 10 inches of rainfall a year, can't grow grain crops. It's only green momentarily in the spring until the heat comes up and the grass withers and the grass dries, and everything is brown down there. And so those are the three thoughts that I think if we were in a helicopter, we realize typifies this land of milk and honey. Green in the north, whitish gray in the central, and sandy tan brown in the south. Well, what you can do in the north, you can't do in the south. And so the perfect animal that can not only survive, but thrive in the southern part of the country is the goat and goat's milk. And that's the origin of the phrase milk and honey. We're making reference to goat's milk here. Now, goats have some fantastic qualities for this kind of environment. They're very durable. They're very sure-footed. They can go without water for a considerable period of time. Their milk is more in volume per animal than a sheep's, and it has 40% higher butterfat content, which makes for cheeses and yogurts, which are wonderful for a nomadic shepherding kinds of people. And so the goat is the ideal animal of the South. And so to paraphrase the land of milk and honey, it's the land of green and tan. It's the land of shepherds and farmers in the north. And I have to now finish this off. We have goats in the south. And when we think of honey, we Westerners anyway, think of bees. And there'd be some correlation to that. Bees are going to be around where there's foliage. And in the north, originally in the country, is where the date palm tree originated. Now it's all throughout the country. And history would suggest that if you take dates and you put them in a container and you mash them up and you stir them every once in a while and you let them ferment a little bit, they become sort of a thick, syrupy kind of compound, hence the phrase associated with that date palm mash. It's called honey. And so the land of milk and honey is the lands of goats and date palm jelly, for lack of a better word, to sort of get it closer to our world here. So that's what that phrase means. That's what that contains. An abundance of goats in the south and an abundance of date palms and the derivative products of date palms in the north.
So do we listen to that phrase and we say, well, that's just a literal description of the land that was given to us in the Old Testament or given to the Israelis, the Hebrews? Or was it meant, it doesn't sound like it, like the milk and honey we understand, which means kind of easy, life is easy, and it's plentiful. You know, you don't go hungry, you don't lack for anything. It sounds like plentitude to us. What did it sound like to them?
Well, yeah, I mean, put yourself in Abram's sandals here. The Lord has brought him to this promised land, and he remembers how lush, relatively speaking, the north was, and yet he ends up in Beersheba, in the desert. If you were Abram, wouldn't you wonder, shouldn't we maybe go 120 miles north and live in a little better environment here? And of course, God led him to Beersheba. And that's, I would suggest, was God's way of protecting Abraham. by putting him in a more severe environment so that he would be much more inclined, perhaps even forced, to lean upon Yahweh for provision. Because you see, the nature and character of the land tends to shape the spiritual destiny of the people who live in the land. And I think the extreme example of this is the divided kingdom period. Of the 19, or if you will, 20 monarchs who governed the north, how many of those were loyal to Yahweh for even a small portion of their reign? And the answer is zero. And if you look at the 19 monarchs that governed the south during that same period of time, how many of them bent a knee towards Yahweh and worshiped him for a significant portion of their reign, like Hezekiah? The answer is 11. Now, I wouldn't wish the taking of statistics upon anybody, but if you do take statistics, there's such a thing called statistical significance. It's defined by something called a p-value. And in statistical analysis, when you have a correlation of 0 of 19 for one sampling and 11 of 19 from another cohort sample, that is highly, highly statistically significant. Now, can you connect the dots on this observation? Why did so many of the monarchs of the south be loyal to Yahweh, while none of the monarchs in the north were loyal to Yahweh, and correlate that to the land of milk and honey? Yes, you can.
Because they knew scarcity.
And in the north, they knew abundance. Hmm. You can provide for yourself in the north, good soil, adequate rain, flat land, compared to no very little rain and not very fertile soil in the south. And you can take care of yourself. But in the south, you're just 90 days removed from an insect infestation, a drought, or even, to use that word in the Bible that brings terror into people's hearts and minds, severe drought. And so you better live close to Yahweh. Okay? So the nature and character of the land tends to shape the spiritual destiny and nature of the people who live in the land. And so God bringing Abram through the north and through the central part of the country, but positioning him in the south, was a very protective thing to have done for Abraham's spiritual welfare.
Let me ask another, because this just made me, this gave me another thought here. If we go back to the captivity, Babylon, the first wave of refugees, maybe the culture as a whole, the Jewish part of Babylon, longed for the temple, the great days of Israel again under David, and their motivation was to get back and reconstruct the temple, and go to Jerusalem and make it great once again. That was the object of their affection. But the later waves of refugees, say first and second and third centuries B.C., settled in the north, didn't they? Where life was easier. I wonder if that colored their whole culture and added to that notion of separation.
I would suggest that's probably a minor part of their thinking. Mm-hmm. Because to pick up your line of thought, that's how the Gentiles thought. And that's why almost all of the Gentiles can be found in the north in this country, not in the south. And so where's the last place that Jews want to live? Around Gentiles. Mm-hmm. But these Jews who came back in progressive ways from Babylon, once the Hasmonean dynasty was installed and Jews were governing Jews again, and they now felt freed to go back home because Jews were governing Jews again in 140 BC, 130 BC, 120 BC. Many of those Jewish exiles who were returning positioned themselves in the north because they believed that Isaiah 9 prophecy, that Messiah would first be seen in the lands of Zebulun and Naphtali, which is where Nazareth and Capernaum are. And they're actually messianic zealots, and they decided to live in the midst of Gentiles because that's what the prophecy says. That's where Messiah is going to be seen first. And while we're waiting for him, let's do whatever we can to cleanse this land from the Gentiles in the north. I would say that was much more shaping in their thinking. But let me finish up here on this land of milk and honey. It comes with a spiritual challenge every time we hear that word. Because if it's true that the nature and character of the land in which you live tends to shape your spiritual destiny, where do the vast majority of us live in America, economically speaking, in the green or in the tan? Mm-hmm. We live in the green. And living in the green is dangerous to your spiritual health, your spiritual welfare, your spiritual destiny. And so the challenge, the spiritual challenge for you and I today and everyone who's listening to this broadcast is this. Even though while we live in the green physically, spiritually and mentally and emotionally, we have to live in this land as if we're in the tan. And we have to do both at the same time, which is awfully hard for the Gentile mind, which is either or. Look, I can do one or the other. But the Jewish mind can do both. It's all about synthesis and fusing and keeping those two thoughts together. And I think that's the parting challenge to this phrase, the land of milk and honey. As we live in the United States in this abundance of green, it can be dangerous to our health, materialism, etc., coveting, etc. So even though we live in the green every day, our hearts and minds and souls have to reside in the tan all day long.
Well, I will think of milk and honey as in a whole different light now. It's about scarcity and abundance. It's tension. It's a division and fascinating too. We're talking with Doug Greenwald, senior teaching fellow at Preserving Bible Times. They have a marvelous website, by the way. It's preservingbibletimes.org. And I know Doug and his whole IBC team at the Institute of Biblical Context are preparing for the big three-day conference in Zeeland, Michigan, coming up in the middle of June. And you can find out more about that at the Preserving Bible Times site. There's also an instituteofbiblicalcontext.com website you can go to. And you can link to PBT, Preserving Bible Times, right there from the Broken Road site if you're listening there today. Doug, thanks very much.
Thanks, Jim.
And we'll talk to you next week.
You bet.
And you're busy today. See you, Doug. Bye-bye.